John Hambrock and Ann Morse Hambrock to talk about their comic strip, The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee. At the most recent gala gathering of the National Cartoonist Society to present the organization's Reuben Awards, The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee was named Best Newspaper Comic Strip. Although the award was officially presented to John Hambrock, he would be the first to say that Ann Morse Hambrock has been an indispensable partner in this great adventure. She colors the strip and is certainly John's most valuable advisor. Here's an excerpt from our conversation. For the sake of any listeners who maybe don't remember kind of the backstory of all of this, I think it would be good to at least briefly retrace some of that. And maybe we should begin with the fact, John, that long before the debut of The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee, you had long pondered and even attempted a couple of launches of comic strips before this comic strip that finally took flight. Just sketch that for our listeners.
Yeah, well, I want to say it goes back, and Ann and I disagree on this, but I want to say 30 years. Our oldest son was, I think, a year old. And literally, I came home one night from work. I worked in Chicago, and I came home and I said to Ann, just out of the blue, you know, I'd like to do a comic strip. And Greg, I have no idea where that came from. I think she had been influencing me when I was sleeping at night, giving me little little talks about what I wanted to do. Because she
was
always
a big
into comics.
Comics fan.
And decided to give it a try. And I had no idea where to begin. I mean, really had no idea. I went to the library, asked the librarian, you know, who do I talk to about doing a comic? And you get these stares and, oh, well, you know, maybe try this or this or this. And so they put me in touch with information that would get me in the door. You know, which I didn't have any idea at the time that this door was heavily guarded and that it took a lot to get in, even to get that door to open. So I tried for years to get various comic creations through that door and into the hands of these syndicates. And one of the first comics I worked on actually was one that we had created together. It was called Second Nature. We did it for a couple years and sent it off to the major syndicates. There were quite a few at the time. And got some positive feedback, which was great. And when you get that feedback, it's like when you buy a lottery ticket for the first time and you win, you think, oh, this is easy. I can do this. Well, it wasn't that easy, but they offered encouragement and said, try this or come back to us in 6 months or no, this is not what we're looking for.
Do I remember correctly that when you created that and you felt really good about it, a problem was that maybe some other comic strip had been launched right around the same time that was a little too similar, which points to the fact that even if you come up with something wonderful, if there's already something in the pipeline that resembles it, that the timing just might not be right. Am I remembering that correctly?
You are correct. The timing on Second Nature was they had just launched the comic Over the Hedge. So, yes.
And I'd like to pull something in here. He recently dug out all his rejection letters from those years before we went to the awards ceremony. I think we just wanted to remind ourselves. And for anybody listening out there that's trying to, I don't know how many people still try to pursue syndication because there are so many more avenues now, but there was something that we could see in those letters now, having been in the business for so long, that we kind of missed at the time. And it was that despite all the encouragement, all the kind words about, yes, you have talent, we love the art, we love the writing, what they were subtly saying in each of these letters was, but not this concept. We can't sell this concept. Come back to us with a new concept. And we must have spent 4 more years sending them more of the same with the mistaken idea, oh, they just haven't seen enough of this concept yet. No, they had seen enough of the concept. They were telling us to switch gears, and we were not getting that memo.
You just didn't see that in their words.
Yeah,
somehow.
I can see that now, but at the time, that was really going over our heads.
Fascinating. By the way, Ann, before we resume the storyline for the creation of Edison Lee, tell us about this long-held love that you've had for newspaper comic strips. When did that begin, and for any particular reason?
I think I was like a lot of kids whose first reading wasn't books. My first reading was my parents' Peanuts comic book collections. And when I say the first Peanuts. I mean, the really old books from the 50s when Charlie Brown, when they all looked like really little kids and Snoopy's kind of a puppy. Between that and my dad was a big fan of New Yorker cartoons, so there were always like Charles Adams books around the house and things like that, that I think children understand. They learn to read better when there's a picture that goes with what they're reading, and they're drawn to that. So I was reading comics really early. And to be fair, too, ours was a newspaper house. When we talk about the generation that doesn't read newspapers anymore, it goes way back further than just our current batch of kids. It goes to John's and to our generation. Already there were many people when we were growing up who didn't even get a newspaper, who got all their news from the TV or from the radio. So I grew up in a newspaper house. My parents were avid readers. That kind of pushed me into reading. And so I had definite pet comics that I followed. I was a big fan of Bloom County, so much so that before we were married, I had started like cutting them out and putting them in a scrapbook for posterity because there weren't any book collections at that time. Wow. So when he says I was like infecting him in his sleep, well, maybe I was.
Fair enough, and a good thing you did. And John, we probably haven't even said this yet, but your professional life includes drawing. So it's not that you came to this with a complete lack of expertise, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I was actually, and this story, Ann gets tired of hearing it, but one of my accounts in Chicago at the agency was Keebler. So I was drawing Keebler elves for about 3 or 4 years. And it was while working on that account that I realized that I could do cartooning. You know, because prior to that, Greg, I wasn't into comics. I wasn't into superheroes as a kid, you know, any of that. So this just came out of nowhere and just smacked me in the head and said, this is what you're going to do. And I'm glad I did because I enjoy doing it. But boy, it sure took a long time to get to that point.
Right. So as you were spinning the tale earlier, you made some of your first attempts, but with rejections. And although I'm sure those rejections stung, something about them, I guess there was enough encouragement in the content of those rejection letters that you did not lose hope.
No. In fact, I just kept my head down and kept pushing ahead because it's interesting. I got to the point where I knew that this is what I was going to do. I just knew that. And you're very lucky in life if you get to that point where you see something that you want your life to be all about and you pursue it and you know with a passion. There are so many people wandering around looking for what they want to do in life, and this was what I wanted to do, and it hit me, and I was going to make it happen no matter what. And I had no idea at the time the odds that this was going to be, you know, and I'm glad I didn't because it may have discouraged me. But it's interesting. One of those letters that I found was from an editor, and I'm good friends with this editor now, and the letter, he or she, I won't even tell you if it was gender, because the editor commented about how the writing fell flat and it just didn't have what it would take to be syndicated. And I sent this editor that letter just right before the awards. This editor knew that I was nominated for this big award, and I sent it to, and I'll say it. She got back to me and said, it was just appalled. She says, oh my God, did I say that? Oh my goodness. You know, she felt so horrible about saying something. And I looked at Anne, I said, this isn't really a bad thing. It's constructive criticism like that that helps you move on and get better about what you're working on.
I do think it was jarring at the time, though, because it was coming at the same time that other editors were saying the humor was good. So this is another difficult thing to navigate, is you hear one thing from one editor and you hear another thing from another editor, and it reminds you how subjective all of this is.
Sure, absolutely. What I'm also thinking about as you're describing this is the fact that obviously we're talking about two aspects of a comic strip: the visual and the writing. I mean, the words that are in the comic strip. I mean, unless it's one of those rare instances of a comic strip that has few, if any, words. But yours had words, and it had drawings. And I suspect that you know, in a sense, you're kind of juggling two balls. And was there one that felt more comfortable than the other, or did it always feel like a single piece and you felt like it was just kind of one artistic expression?
You know, no one's ever asked me that question in that way before. And that's interesting, Greg, you bring that up, because, yes, the two do go hand in hand. When I'm writing, it's funny, I'll write it. I do my writing on my laptop or my desktop, and I come up with ideas. But then when I draw them up, and Anne will often hear me laughing, because once I draw them up and I see them on the paper, they're really funny. It takes sometimes that moment when you see the physical drawings of these characters that adds that little final touch of humor that makes it work.
Interesting.
When Hillary Price was here, part of her talk was she said that there's kind of a famous idea that there are writers who draw and artists who write. You know, that each comic comes, that you have a strength in one direction or another. And this is going to sound a little arrogant, but I think John's one of those that it's equally weighted. And I do think that's a little unusual.
Right. And I should think most people at least probably regard one as a more natural gift than the other, and the other kind of hauls the other one along. But yeah, that's cool that you felt comfortable with both talents. So at some point, does the message start to sink in that we need to create a new concept, and ultimately The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee is that concept?
Absolutely. You know, I had done a comic with a little boy in it, and he was a minor character. But as I developed this comic, this little boy just kept screaming out to me, demanding more and more attention. And so I finally gave in and said, okay, let's see what you can do, kid. And I started writing some comics for this little boy. He was a smart little genius kid. And, you know, it got mediocre response because it was just a typical kid doing typical things, which you see. And there was nothing really extraordinary about him. And then we had the 2000 presidential election and the whole thing with George Bush and the hanging chads and the delay and all that in the Supreme Court. And that got me riled up, Greg, and I started just out of the blue, I just started throwing in these adult situations, this political humor, some of it, a lot of it, into this world with this little kid. It's like putting everything in a blender and turning it on, just seeing what comes out. And it just the science angle of it and the politics and this little boy and the coming out of his mouth and all that. And I said, that resonated with me. I thought, this is really fun. Let's see where this goes. And I did some of those and I sent them off, and that's finally what got the attention of one of the editors at King Features, who said, I like this. Let's develop this into something more. So that's what it took. I give the election credit for a lot.
Wow.
And I think a really important part of that story is that it was missing passion up until that point. If you don't have anything particular to say, if you just see a job you'd like to do, oh, I'd like to do a comic strip, that's one thing. His work really came to life when he now felt he had something to say. And I think the syndicates, they're looking for a point of view to a limit. They're not necessarily looking for a soapbox, because then they can't sell that across broad audiences, but they are looking for heart. They're looking for something that's coming from a place deeper inside you that's not just on the surface. And I do think that's part of what made them suddenly take notice.
Anne Morse Hambrock and John Hambrock talking about their comic strip, The Brilliant Mind of Edison Lee. This interview aired back on October 20th, and you can hear it in its entirety if you seek out the Morning Show archive on our website, WGTD.org. You're listening to Morning Show Saturday. I'm Gregory Berg. Next, I want to share with you an interview I was thrilled to record with Cody Keenan, who served for a time as the chief speechwriter for President Barack Obama. This is the third time that I've actually had the privilege of speaking with a presidential speechwriter. In Cody Keenan's book, Grace, President Obama and 10 Days in the Battle for America, he focuses on a 10-day period that was especially tense and dramatic as the American public awaited groundbreaking decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court regarding the Affordable Care Act as well as same-sex marriage. During that same 10-day period, a tragic mass shooting occurred at a church in Charleston, and President Obama was invited to deliver the eulogy at the memorial service. Here is Coney Keenan in our interview about his book called Grace. I think a lot of people are not going to know until they read your book, Grace, about the work that you did earlier in your career as an intern for Senator Ted Kennedy. What was most valuable about those years working for Senator Kennedy in terms of what you ultimately went on to do with President Obama?
That internship was my best learning experience, my best political learning experience. I was fresh out of college, opening letters in the mailroom and routing them to where they needed to go to get people help. And you read these letters, and it changes the way you think about politics. I mean, these are people not just from Massachusetts, but all over the country, writing to the last Kennedy brother to tell them about their lives, ask for help. And there's this real hope in those letters that even if someone's going through a tough time, somebody on the other side is going to read this and care enough to do something about it. And that changed the way I thought about politics forever. And even when I was writing speeches for President Obama, we would work in people's stories who wrote letters to him in the White House.
One of the chief themes in the book as you get into your work with President Obama is the matter of writing important speeches in moments of grief. Back in 2011, when you had to help write President Obama's eulogy delivered for the mass shooting where people were killed and Gabby Gifford seriously injured. And of course, what we'll talk about in more detail, 2015, when a white supremacist murdered 8 worshipers and their pastor in a Charleston, South Carolina church. In those moments where a eulogy is being presented, which under normal circumstances would be an entirely personal outpouring, what is it like to have to sort of make it also something, at least in some ways, political that speaks to important issues? What kind of a fine line does one walk when you are both writing and ultimately delivering a eulogy under those kind of circumstances?
You're absolutely right. I think for, you know, to be asked to give a eulogy is actually a pretty special honor to you're the one who's chosen to sum up somebody's life. It is rare, though, that you're going to have a battery of camera lenses staring at you and broadcasting it out into the world. That's where a president giving a eulogy is something different. And the way he always viewed it was, you know, we're here to sum up somebody's life, but I'm also here to bring up what are our obligations and responsibilities now that this person's gone? What do we do to carry on their life? What do we do to, unfortunately, prevent crises like these from happening again? And these are after mass shootings. And you know, after Tucson, he didn't really go hard on guns in that eulogy. Newtown was a different story. After 20 little kids were murdered in their classrooms, along with 6 of their educators, you know, he wanted to signal in that eulogy that we were going to try to do something about this. And that not to politicize that is a political choice. Not to do something about guns is a political choice. And after Charleston, you know, you've got the added component of race. And he literally used the lyrics to Amazing Grace in that speech to say, listen, maybe we have been blind to the unique gun mayhem that gun violence inflicts on the country and the pain that Confederate flag stirs in citizens and how racism still infects every segment of our society, but we can open our eyes. Maybe we can see that now. And it's just kind of a beautiful way to do it.
Mm. You talk in your book about the really torturous process of crafting this a eulogy for him to deliver in Charleston, a eulogy which initially he was very reluctant to deliver. I think at one point he kind of said, I've run out of words when it comes to talking about this, but ultimately was persuaded to do that. Would you share with our listeners that really touching moment when you ultimately apologized to President Obama, I think for the very first time in all the years that you had worked with him, over what you felt like you had at least to that point failed to do with this particular speech?
Yeah, if people think this book is self-promotion, they're going to be pleasantly surprised that it's not. It's hard to write for President Obama. It was always a struggle because he was better at it than we were, and he had really high expectations. But he also, the country had high expectations of him, which is why it was difficult. And he didn't want to give the Charleston eulogy at first, just because we had done so many. And after, you know, a background checks bill was defeated in the Senate a couple years earlier, he said, what am I going to do the next time this happens? You know, I don't want to be the one who just gives a eulogy and gives people permission to move on. After Charleston, it was what the families did by the families of the victims forgave the killer in this extraordinary act of grace, and that was ultimately what tipped him over into giving the eulogy. And I was struggling with it because, again, it touched on race and guns and the Confederate flag, and it's just a lot all at once to work into a speech while we were also working on speeches. The Supreme Court was poised to rule on Obamacare and marriage equality. You know, we were writing speeches for whether or not millions of Americans would lose their health insurance or be told they couldn't get married. And it was a lot. And I gave him a draft the night before. And he, for the first time ever, just drew a big line through the last two pages, just completely deleted them and rewrote them by himself in 3 hours. So that's why I apologized. It was the first time he'd done that to me, but it was the first time that I'd let him down like that. And he did something cool. He put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Look, brother, we're collaborators. You gave me what I needed to work with here. You're going to recognize some of your work and what I did. And when you've been thinking about this stuff for 40 years, you'll know what you want to say too." And that's just kind of the kind of boss he was. You know, he didn't let me leave there feeling bad about myself.
Wow. I had the privilege of speaking with David Frum several years ago on this program, who was a speechwriter for the younger President Bush. And he talked in his book about the really significant challenge of trying to find the voice of the president for whom he was writing. I mean, to write words that would, even though he was writing them, would sound like President Bush's own words. And I suspect with President Obama was very much a similar kind of challenge, writing words that would feel right being delivered by President Obama and in his voice.
Absolutely. I mean, it took me a couple of years to truly get there. And the added difficulty to it is that I'm a white man, you know, who grew up in relative privilege on the north side of Chicago. And he's a black man who grew up not knowing his father and living all around the world. And we just had totally different life experiences. That doesn't make it any more difficult to get into somebody's head. I think race makes it a little harder because we just, there's just really no way to truly imagine what this country is like if you haven't lived it as a black person. But I would talk to him all the time. We would work before speeches. We'd sit. We'd really discuss, what are we trying to say here? You know, tell me about your experience. And that's really the job of a speechwriter, is not to put words into somebody's mouth, but to help them come up, to try to anticipate what they would write if they had the time. So I always spent a lot of time with him on the front end of a speech.
A last question, although I think people will be really interested to read about your relationship with President Obama. Some of the most interesting stuff in the book is also about the perpetual feedback you would receive from other staff members and advisors, and particularly those who would want certain elements inserted into speeches. What was that like? How frustrating was that to have that be sort of part of the machinery of creating these speeches for President Obama?
Yeah, it could be pretty frustrating when there are too many cooks in the kitchen. But, you know, at the same time, everyone had the same goal, which is to make the best speech possible. Sometimes people wanted to insert their own little bailiwicks into it, and that was a challenge. But everybody always had the same goal, and you'd remind yourself of that, whether it was the policy people or the fact checkers. You know, our fact checkers were really hard on us. And I ended up marrying one of them. And it was her job to give me a document every day that was meticulously sourced and cited to tell me why I was wrong, all the 20 different ways I was wrong every single day. And we're still married. So it all came from a place of love.
The book is Grace, President Obama and 10 Days in the Battle for America, and the author, Cody Keenan, head speechwriter for President Obama. Mr. Keenan, I loved your book, and thank you so much for giving me the privilege of speaking with you today.
Greg, it was all my privilege. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Morning Show Saturday. I'm Gregory Berg. I spoke over the last several weeks about several different theatrical productions here in southeastern Wisconsin, and I especially enjoyed my conversation with a faculty colleague at Carthage, Matt Hoagland, about Carthage's production of the groundbreaking musical Hair. Matt, it occurs to me that Hair is one of those rare shows that is so of its time and yet timeless in some ways and timely all these years later. What is your sense of this show? You told me before we went on the air that this is a show you've loved for a long, long time and have some experience with.
Yeah, I was lucky to music direct a production of this in Provincetown, Massachusetts several years ago with my good friend Kyle, it's his birthday today, so happy birthday, Kyle. But I got to, I wrote this in the program notes because this was really special to me. I got to meet this this woman named Ricky, and Ricky is a drummer based out of Provincetown. And she's a wonderful human. We come in, we start having rehearsals, and she's like, can I share something with the kids? Because she was someone who was alive during the time of the Vietnam War and was alive during the time that Hair came out and all of the popular songs that we knew. And I said, yeah, absolutely. Like, what do you want to share? And she's like, well, before I was Ricky, I was Richard, and I had a draft card and I burned it in protest. And wow. So Ricky showed us then Richard's draft card that she had kept all of these years. And it was, you know, burned on the side, and it was in this notebook with then her former driver's license. And, it was in that moment that sort of Hair became really real to me. Mm. It wasn't just a show. It wasn't just a story. And it wasn't just about some event that happened before I was born. It now became something really personal to me. Mm. And being able to sit next to Ricky every night performing that show, and Ricky just playing those drums and singing at the top of her lungs because she could, it just... just made it real, and made it such a transformative experience for me. And I knew I wanted to do it wherever I went, wherever I started working or whatever I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to do that at that institution because to me, what Hair represents is not only historical, but it actually represents a group of people coming together and a group of people going after a common cause. And there's just... you know, after COVID, after all the things, and in our current state, I just felt like we needed a come together moment. And so that's why I did it. And then when I approached the campus pastor and asked if I could use the chapel for Hair, she immediately responded, yes, absolutely, and wanted to know if we were doing the famous nude scene in it, which we are not, for the record. So it's just, to me, it's just like a great... not only historical show that is still relevant today, and we tell it in a way in which it is, which I'm really, really thankful for the collaborators on this project. I have a grad student, Kevin, who is directing it with me. And then we also have an alumni of the program, Austin Winter, who has choreographed and staged most of it. And so it's been really great to have those voices in the room, to have BIPOC voices in the room, to have queer voices in the room on this project from, you know, 1964, 67, whenever it was first induced and created. And so it's just to do it in 2022 in a chapel on the coast of Lake Michigan is, I couldn't imagine doing it anywhere else.
Did anything in particular draw you to want to do it in Siebert Chapel? That's not where most of the musical theater productions occur. Just the size so that you can fit more people in? I suspect it had more to do with than that.
Yeah, it wasn't so much about the size. It was the idea of what would Hair look like? What would this topic look like in a church? And how do we as audience members walk into a chapel and immediately think one thing, right? Or we walk into any sort of religious space and think something, right? We usually end up thinking something is sacred, something is like not touchable, something is there's definitely a higher power or a higher something that we're there for. And so when you look at a bunch of, to use the term, hippies who are just walking into this space and sort of taking it over, that was something that really seemed interesting to me.
Wow. Matt Hoagland is on the music faculty at Carthage, coordinator of the music theater program there, and director of this production of Hair. Performances are this weekend and next weekend in Carthage College's Siebert Chapel. And if you would like to hear any of these interviews in their entirety or any other morning show interviews that you might have missed, you can find the morning show archive on our website, wgtd.org. That does it for this edition of Morning Show Saturday. I'm Gregory Berg. Thanks for listening. Have a wonderful day.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, join the Racine Symphony for a wine tasting fundraiser Friday, November 18th at Uncorked in downtown Racine. This month featuring Iralian wine and food. Tickets are available at racinesymphony.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center has launched a new family caregiver support group that meets in person and virtually the first Thursday of every month. For more information, call 262-605-6600.